listener production.
A warning. This episode contains references to violent crimes. The number for Lifeline is 13 11 14. Please listen with care. Welcome to Crime Insiders Forensics. For those joining us for the first time, my name's Catherine Fox. I'm a former GP, crime author, and screenwriter. I'm enthralled by forensics and have spent thousands of hours researching for books and screenplays. So I thought, why not turn my research into a podcast? Every week, you'll be joining me in discovering how forensic science is helping solve high-profile crimes in Australia and around the world. This week, how killers are caught using 3D crime scene recreation technology.
Not only can the laser scanner produce still images of that scene environment from any angle or view that you wish, you can fly through as though you're there in the room.
Angus Newton is one of New Zealand's most respected ballistics experts. He's an encyclopedia of ballistic evidence, and today is walking us through a case that occurred just before 3D technology became commonplace. Then we'll understand how things might have been different if that 3D technology was there to be used. So, to start, we're going back to 2009 to a drug deal gone wrong and two people looking for revenge.
The drug dealer ripped off the two customers, and subsequently attempts were made by the two customers to complete the deal. And that involved inviting the drug dealer to their place with some deal sweeteners just to get their complete the sale. So they invited him around. And the victim turned up to their flat in Palmerston North. He would have entered the room through the front door, which led directly into the lounge. He would have shut the door behind him and turned and faced a modified rifle being pointed in his direction. I don't know what went down in between the time he entered that room and when the shot was fired, but the good thing about this particular case is what occurred inside that room enabled me to fully reconstruct events. Firearms can be excellent storytellers. They can give you everything that occurred in that snapshot of time when that bullet leaves the muzzle of the gun and strikes the victim. Or alternatively, they can actually keep their secrets very close to their chest. And thankfully for us in this instance, the gun decided to give up all its secrets.
Did you actually attend the crime scene when you heard there was a shooting?
Yes, yeah. So I received the call, I think, towards the evening of the day of the shooting, with a request to come down and attend the scene the following day. So we took steps to organise that trip from Auckland to Palmerston North to arrive the following day of the shooting.
What do you actually take in your scene kit?
These days it's changed. I can't recall what we took right back in 2009 because systems have changed. So we operate across the country, but we also have general scene attendant staff based in Auckland, Wellington and Christchurch. And they will assist us at scenes these days. So the firearms examiners will attend a scene. If we have to fly to, for instance, Palmerston North, then a general scene examiner from Wellington will drive up and they'll bring the sort of equipment that a general scene requires. So that's protective gear, blood testing equipment, shoe print kits, luminol kits, any other sort of equipment that requires or is required for general scene and examinations. And we would just take the firearm-specific equipment, so things that we need to record the firearm evidence and assist with the reconstruction. So trajectory kits, for instance, tools for removing bullets from walls, those sorts of firearm-specific gear requirements.
What's a trajectory kit?
A trajectory kit contains the equipment that's required to reconstruct a trajectory. So in order to reconstruct a trajectory, you need 2 points in space where a bullet has passed through. So, for instance, a good example would be a bullet passing through an internal wall. It will leave a hole in the first wall, pass through the wall cavity, and then exit out the other side. And so you have 2 points in space, or the entry hole and the exit hole in this case. So that's all we need to reconstruct a trajectory, and we can join those 2 points in space and extend it either backwards to where the shot has been fired from, or forward to where the bullet has travelled towards. And there are various methods of connecting those 2 points and extending it out. The most commonly used would be a trajectory rod, and it's a straight metal rod, generally coated in coloured plastic. And so you can insert the rod into the entry hole, through the wall cavity, and out through the exit hole, and that instantly captures the direction of the bullet through that wall cavity. So you can see the direction, whether it's upwards, downwards direction, left or right. Then you can attach lasers to the end of the trajectory rod and point it forward towards where the bullet might have travelled to, and you might need to do that to look downrange and try and find other surfaces that the bullet struck. Or you can put the laser on the entrance side and point it back to where the gun would have been located. And you can do that for multiple trajectory rods, for example, and maybe pinpoint a location where the gun was fired and where the aim point was changed. And that can help you reconstruct events.
When you arrived, what did you find at the scene?
The first job that we were required to look at was where the deceased was located. He had left the shooting incident location and walked about 80 metres down the road, and then because of the loss of blood that he was suffering from, he collapsed behind a brick wall at an address on the same street. And that's where he was located. So our first task was to examine the victim's body, his location, and anything else that might have been in his immediate vicinity that would assist with the reconstruction.
Did you then go back to the actual scene and then try and put it together then, or did you wait until post-mortem? What's the sort of steps that you did to try and reconstruct what had happened in that apartment?
The interesting aspect of the deceased's scene was the presence of the firearm. The firearm was located originally right next to where the deceased was located. It had been uplifted and taken away by police the previous evening. You don't want to leave a firearm overnight in a scene if possible. And so that was checked for safety by the investigating officers and exhibited and taken away that night. So I hadn't had a chance to see it, but I was made aware that the firearm had been located next to the body, and that was relevant to events that transpired subsequent to that. The next stage was to look at the intervening space between where the deceased was located and the flat where the incident took place. And that was just to track the deceased's movements, and that was easy enough to do because he was bleeding a lot, and so those bloodstains were easily visible on the road and pavement, and so it was easy enough to track his movements in the intervening space. Once we'd done that, then it was time to go to the post-mortem. And so that was undertaken on the following day. We travelled down to Wellington, where the post-mortem was to take place, and attended that post-mortem.
When you're there at the post-mortem, presumably they x-rayed the body to see if there were any bullets still inside. Did you find anything at the scene before that? Any bullet marks or bullets themselves or cartridges, anything? Was there anything left at the scene?
At that stage, we hadn't got into the main shooting scene. So we were kind of operating a little bit blind, more so than we would normally. You'd normally look at the main scene. In most instances, the body is actually deceased within the main scene area where the shooting took place. This was a little bit different because he had walked away from the scene for some distance and we didn't get a chance to look at that main shooting scene before we got to the post-mortem. So a little bit different. We knew after the x-ray that there were no bullets inside the victim. There was an entrance and an exit wound, amongst other things. So we knew that when we did get into the main shooting incident scene, we'd be looking for the bullet that had struck and passed through the victim.
There was only one bullet wound?
There was only one shot fired, but there were actually multiple wounds. The results from the post-mortem showed that the bullet had originally crossed his lower neck, close to where his right collarbone is located. Had then crossed from right to left and entered his shoulder just above his left armpit. It had travelled across the tissue immediately above his left armpit, severing his nerves and his arteries and veins that go into his left arm, and then exited out of the rear of his left shoulder. So general direction was slightly downwards and from his right to left.
Initially, when you think about that, you think, okay, was his arm by his side or where was his arm? He was obviously moving in time and space. People would normally just stand there, I imagine. How was the arm then? I'm just trying to work it out. If it's gone through at that angle and then damaged the nerves and veins.
So this is jumping slightly ahead. Later on in laboratory, we got a chance to look at the victim's clothing, including the sweatshirt that he was wearing at the time. The really interesting finding from that sweatshirt was a number of holes across the upper right sleeve and across his chest on the right-hand side. So I think there were about seven holes. We detected copper around the hole that was at the very right end of that series of holes. So that was the first entry hole, because as the bullet passes through a surface, it deposits what we call bullet wipe on the surface around the entry hole. And it'll only generally be the first hole that it passes through. Every subsequent hole, that bullet wipe generally has mostly disappeared, although there are exceptions to that. But in this instance, we detected copper around that rightermost hole, and the sequence of seven holes showed us that the bullet had passed in and out of that sweatshirt as it travelled across from his right shoulder across his chest. The post-mortem results show that there were no injuries to him in that location. So the bullet had never actually struck him. It had only passed through the sweatshirt in that location. It then struck his neck, or his lower neck, about where its voice box is located, before entering his body just above his left arm. So if you actually, by the time you elevate his sweatshirt, his right arm, and you elevate it and you extend it straight out and probably slightly up, then that explains the seven holes across that right sleeve onto his chest. And then you actually have to bring your head down for the bullet then to crease that his neck and then travel across and strike his into just above his left armpit. So that almost paints a picture of a possible defence posture. He's almost raised his right arm to fend off what's coming whilst attempting to crouch down to evade what's coming. So that could be one explanation for that.
Were there any people of interest at the time?
Yes, there were. So there were believed to be two people inside the flat apart from the victim. One person held and fired the gun, and there was believed to be another person there at the time. And those were the two people who had been ripped off during the drug deal.
Were they in police custody, or were they on the run? Where were they at the time? of the postmortem and the crime scene examination.
So several hours after when the shot was believed to have fired, they presented themselves to the local police station and informed the police that there had been a shooting at the flat where they were living. But their story ultimately didn't marry up with the evidence. So their original story that they told police was that the victim had turned up their flat with a firearm and had threatened them with the firearm. A fight had taken place, and during that fight, the gun had been fired accidentally, and the victim had received the gunshot. He had subsequently left the flat and died down the road. They told the police that they were unsure what had happened to the victim after he left the flat, and they were there to inform the police of this incident. So that was their version of events.
But they didn't call an ambulance or call police in the meantime?
No, there was several hours in between when the shooting had took place and by the time they decided to present to police.
So where are you up to now? You've got the gun. You've now gone back to the crime scene after the post-mortem. So what happens now with your involvement?
Yeah, so after the post-mortem, the following day, so day three of our involvement in the investigation, I'm back in the main scene. So we finally get back to the flat where the incident occurred and walk into the lounge where the shot is alleged to have been fired and realise that there's a lot of work to be done. The lounge was relatively cluttered, quite full of furniture, and it was clear that a lot of activity had taken place post-shooting, not just in the lounge but in the house generally. The lounge was covered in bloodstains, and there were also bloodstains located in various other locations, and there was firearms evidence as well. Eventually, once we sort of got into the lounge and started examining it in detail, we found a bullet hole in the wall next to the front door. The bullet had passed through the jibboard wall and smacked into the brick wall behind. So that gave us the ability to reconstruct the trajectory. So we were able to, in this instance, we used a string line. So we were able to connect one end of the string to the hole in the brick, pass it back out through the hole in the jib and extend it all the way to the other end of the lounge. And that gives you a line, a trajectory line, upon which both the shooter and the deceased can be placed. They have to be on that trajectory line. The next thing that was noticeable was a forward tissue spatter pattern on the wall surrounding the bullet hole. So that occurs when a bullet exits someone. You will get very, very fine tissue spatter travelling in the same direction as a bullet. So we term that forward tissue spatter. And that very, very fine tissue spatter had deposited on the wall immediately around the entry hole where the bullet had smacked into the jib. And that told us that the deceased was relatively close to that wall when that bullet had exited him and smacked into the jib. So that we could not only then place the deceased along that trajectory line, but we could also place him relatively close to that wall. So we were able to place the deceased pretty close in space, and that was in line with the front door. So he would have been standing pretty close to the front door when he received the shot.
Was the front door open or closed, do you think?
It would have been closed. And the reason I say that is there was a tremendous amount of blood staining on the floor immediately beneath the front door and on the surface of the front door that's facing the inside of the lounge. The blood staining contained drips and transfer stains and spatter stains as well. And the impression was from that blood staining that someone was standing next to that closed front door attempting to get out. So they were trying to manipulate the door handles in order to get out. The front door had two door handles, a lock and a handle. And if you recall from the post-mortem examination, the deceased had lost the use of his left arm because that nerve bundle that serves that arm had been severed. So he actually didn't have the use of his left hand. So he would have been trying to open that front door with just one hand, and with two handles, he would have struggled for some time. And that was reflected in that blood staining. It was just a huge amount of drips and transfers that the impression was that someone had been trying for some time to get out while they were bleeding.
Does that go in the suspect's favour in the sense that, you know, if you're looking at a murder charge, they could have shot him again if they'd intended to murder him while he's trying to escape?
I guess so. And that's a question of intent but that we struggle to answer forensically. Given the mechanism of the rifle that we're dealing with, this firearm was a modified bolt-action rifle, and it would have taken time for that gun to be reloaded and another shot had been fired. The problem with the suggestion that another shot might have been fired was answered by the rest of the blood staining in the room. It was clear that the rifle had been used as a weapon subsequent to the shooting. There was cast-off bloodstains within the room, as though the rifle had been swung around within that room. And you'll recall that the firearm was actually found with the deceased. So the suggestion is that despite using the use of his left arm, the victim was still able to grab the rifle off the shooter, use it to attempt to assault him whilst he's bleeding on it, and then producing cast-off stains as he swung it around within the lounge, and he's then taken it with him when he's left the house. So that would support the suggestion that the victim had brought the gun with him, but then you've got to answer the question, well, how then has he been shot with it? He's then grabbed it back off the shooter and left with it. So all these sorts of open-end questions, but we know that the gun did not arrive with the victim. It had always been at the flat, and we know that because of other evidence that we subsequently located within the house.
What sort of evidence was that?
So we found ammunition with the same calibre and brand as that was used in the shooting. We also found a section of firearm barrel that had been cut off and was physically fitted back to the gun that was used, and also other parts that had been used to modify it. So the original stock had been removed from the firearm and a pistol grip had been placed on the firearm instead, so he converted it from a rifle to a pistol. And we found the other parts of that air pistol that the pistol grip had been taken from. So it had been clear that that rifle had been modified by the person living in that place. So there was no way to support the suggestion that the victim had brought the gun to the flat.
And what's your next step? Were you told the story presented by the suspects, or did you go into that crime scene only with the post-mortem information?
We had no information as to what the suspect's story was at that stage. We were operating independently. Just examining the crime scene as we saw it and gradually letting the evidence lead us towards what had happened. It wasn't until much, much later that we were informed about the suspect's version of events. And then it was just a matter of completing the investigations and the examinations to enable us to reconstruct events based on the evidence rather than any sort of particular story or version.
It sounds monumental, his effort to escape that crime scene.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm still flabbergasted how he managed to get out the door with only one hand. But he did. He managed it. The victim was a bodybuilder. Well, not so much a bodybuilder, but he was definitely he obviously attended gym because he was a very well-built individual. The shooter, on the other hand, was not. The shooter was a drug addict, and body fitness was not his main interest. So there was certainly a discrepancy in physicality, and that may be reflected in what occurred, even given the extent of the victim's injuries and the situation that he was facing.
And there were two people in the room. So the question is, what was the second person doing while this was going on?
And that's possibly why that second person was charged also with murder. That second person denied any involvement in the incident. However, there was a suggestion that they were present based on what I understand to be lipstick found on a beer bottle of the same type that they were seen drinking in town prior to going to the police station, and also text messages from the phone that were sent to the victim asking him to come around and complete the drug deal.
And at trial, how did you present the evidence? Because it sounds, you know, he said, she said kind of concept, that they're saying this happened, and it's obviously a very dynamic scene when somebody is being shot and they're moving and it's in that situation and they're trying to defend themselves or not, or they're the attacker and it goes wrong. So how then do you get that information across to a jury without sort of these great 3D visual reconstructions and things?
I should start off by just outlining what the charges were. So the shooter was charged with murder, and he actually pled guilty. He was under the understanding that if he pled guilty, the other person would not face any charges. Unfortunately, it doesn't work like that. And she was also charged with murder subsequently. She pled not guilty to murder, and that trial went ahead. And that was the first time that I was required to give evidence in this case. This case does precede all the advances that have been made recently with digital evidence and the ability to record the crime scene with a laser scanner and present that digital evidence in court. But we still had the means. We were able to present floor diagrams with trajectory reconstructions in place. So we were able to give the jury an idea of what had happened in terms of the firearms reconstruction. And then it's a matter of very carefully outlining the evidence in a way that the jury can understand, answering questions about the evidence, considering different hypotheses as they're presented to you, and gradually just hoping that your explanations are understandable to the jury, because it's certainly, although it's very much a scientific approach, you do have to pitch it to the jury who aren't scientists, and you have to make it understandable to them. And that's part of the role, is translating that science into a jury so that they can understand and hopefully make good decisions about it.
Today, how would you do that case differently with everything that you've got available now, with digital photography reconstructions? Do you think that would be presented very differently?
Oh, yes, definitely. The advances that we've been able to do by introducing the laser scanner would change how things are done, both at the scene originally. So the time spent in the scene before the laser scanner was introduced is extended because you have to record and measure almost every aspect within that scene. And I recall some of my scene notes are just littered with measurements. So distances between furniture items, overall measurements of the room, heights of various items of interest within the room, lengths of bloodstains, etc., etc. It's so much time was spent with a tape measure recording that scene in your notes. And that's all superseded by the use of the 3D laser scanner now. It can be set up in a room, takes its scans, and that records everything in infinite detail, and you can obtain measurements from that data for any object in the room that's been successfully recorded. So that saves a tremendous amount of time. But then you've also got the outputs that the laser scanner can produce. So not only can the laser scanner produce still images of that scene environment, either from any angle or view that you wish. So for instance, floor diagrams of every piece of furniture or item that's in the room. We can produce any sort of 2D viewpoint that you like. But the other really useful output that the courts are finding extremely useful is digital fly-throughs of the scene. So using a virtual camera, you can fly through any crime scene as though you're there in the room. And that really takes the court, including the jury, into that crime scene and allows them to see that scene for themselves. And that's a tremendous advantage.
When you do test shooting, what are you shooting into and how do you protect the environment from that bullet and how do you stop that bullet from being damaged in the process?
There are various mechanisms that we can apply to our test shooting to recover the bullet. It depends on the caliber of the gun, really. Any high-powered gun requires a sturdier backstop, and steps have to be taken to recover that bullet in an undamaged state. So the first setup that we have that we can use is a water tank. It's a large stainless steel tank that contains a large amount of water, and we point the gun into one end of the tank and fire into the water, and the bullet will strike the water and sink harmlessly to the bottom of the tank, and we can recover it. Now, that's all well and good for small caliber guns like the 22 long rifle or some small caliber handguns. That's not a problem. Those bullets are easily recoverable. The water protects them. They're largely undamaged and they're perfect for our comparisons.
How do you go with bullets that are actually damaged in whatever they embed in, or they've hit bone, or they've been affected by the elements outside? How can you work around that in trying to compare this bullet to this gun and a bullet that you do under controlled circumstances from that gun?
Yeah, good question, Kathy. And it's almost every instance the bullet that we recover will be damaged to some extent. It's just the nature of the job. So we are always faced with the challenge of comparing a less than perfect example to ones that are perfectly obtained. It just depends on the extent of damage. So as long as enough information is left on the bullet as it travels down the barrel and picks up that barrel detail, if there's enough of that information retained on the bullet, then we can work with that. When the damage starts to obscure or obliterate a lot of that detail, then we're limited in the conclusions that we can come to. We may be able to provide an opinion that the bullet could have come from that gun or any other of the same type of gun with the same type of rifling, because all the microscopic detail might have been damaged or obscured. or if there's some of that microscopic detail surviving but not enough to link it to the gun, then our interpretation is adjusted accordingly. We just may not be able to get to the highest level of conclusion that we'd like.
Are homemade guns presenting issues for you now?
Not in huge numbers. We're just encountering our first 3D printed guns, even though they've been available for some time and we've sort of been expecting it. One of the biggest issues for us is blank firing guns. So these are guns that are used by film studios or sporting officials. They fire a blank cartridge. It's a cartridge with no bullet, just the propellant. So it makes the noise and the flash. And in New Zealand, up until recently, you didn't require a firearms license to go and buy one of these guns. And so the criminal fraternity were doing this. They were buying up huge numbers of these blank guns and converting them. These guns have a barrel obstruction, so even if you did put a fully loaded cartridge into this gun and try and fire it, there'd be a barrel obstruction would prevent that bullet from flying out and actually have disastrous consequences for the shooter because that barrel would likely explode. But these people are easy, well-trained to remove those barrel obstructions and essentially turn a blank gun into a normally firing handgun. And that has been a real issue for us in recent times. The proliferation of these guns in the hands of criminals has been noticeable, and we've had our first fatality as well.
Angus, thank you so much for joining us. There's so much more to criminal activity that we just keep learning more and more about that you have to keep ahead of. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you, Kathy. I really appreciate the opportunity to come on to this episode and give you a brief explanation of what we do. It could certainly fill another two or three episodes, so I'll leave that hanging.
Crime Insiders Forensics is a listener original production. It's hosted by me, Catherine Fox, and is produced by Ed Gooden. Sound design and imaging is by Link Kelly.